Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Does this context reflect a protracted logical plan or disjointed maxim, M-A-X, maxim? Now, there is several theories about this chapter. Some think that he's just quoting several proverbs and jumping from subject to subject. Jewish preaching is like that. Jewish preachers kept the attention of their audience by somehow jumping from subject to subject to subject to subject to subject to subject. They call it putting pearls on a string. And what it is what I think the seventh chapter is. I don't think we have a projected argument that goes through the whole chapter, but I think he's quoting an objector here, or quoting a known proverb here and then reacting to it. So it's very disjointed as we go through here. The easiest thing to do would be to hand your Bible to someone next to you that doesn't have the same translation, and all of us read the seventh chapter again. So hand your Bible to someone close to you, a different translation, those of you who have already read it. So if you have a different translation, English, Living, or King James, or something, trade it with someone next to you, okay? Is better than good ointment. Now, what current proverb could that mean? Do what? Don't you dare. If you can't sing the victory thing, you ain't doing nothing. How about an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure? Does that fit? Does it? A good name is better than a good ointment. Now, the ointment can be two things. It can be ointment that's used for healing. That proverb would apply if the ointment is healing ointment, right? But the ointment also is used in the Old Testament most of the time for it's the Old Testament brute, if you please, or Charlie, or something, ladies or men. It's the stinkum you put on before you went out to a party. And that's the way it's always used in the Old Testament when this word ointment's found. So really, it's probably not the ideal of an ounce of prevention, a pound of cure, as it is, that a man's reputation is better than feasting and reveling and pleasure seeking. Now, Proverbs 22:1 is a real parallel passage to this, and you might want to put that in your Bible next to this opening remark. Now, these first six verses, anyway, are organically linked. You can't pull a little phrase out of any part of this and get its true meaning without looking at the total context. And it's going to be very important for us to realize that we are in a context situation, okay? So don't pull anything out of context, especially the idea of death being better than life, is one example. Now, notice if you would, please, when it says, and one day, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Now, what could that possibly mean? If you will turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 4, you will see that we have a play on words and a play on moods. Because in chapter 9, verse 4, he says, for whatever is joined with living, there is hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion. A real poet, isn't he? Well, so you see, he's not saying that death better than life, because the book just won't hold that as a theme. So what is he saying here about the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth? Now, linked to verse 1, there is a play on words in verse 1. The word for name is the word shim. The word for ointment is the word shimin, same word with an E-N on the end of it. Could it possibly be that, and I'm going to use another example so it'll sound funny, but the taste of a good man's name is sweeter than honey, saying that if you have the kind of life that does not have a good reputation, if you've lived the life of a fool, if you've lived the life of self, if you've lived the life of pleasure, and you've come to the end and you found it's all vain and futile and no satisfaction and no reward, then possibly in that context, it would have been better if you didn't live. To come to the end of life and sit down and say, my life has meant absolutely zero. I have lived selfishly. I have lived by stepping on people to get what I want, my life means nothing, then maybe in a context like that, it would be better never to have been born. But verse 2 is related to verse 1. In verse 2, it talks about the house of mourning and the house of feasting. The house of mourning is a Hebrew way of referring to going to the funeral parlor, because they didn't have them, going to the home and sitting with the family that has just experienced death. It's being with those who have experienced the ultimate tragedy of life, the death, either of a loved one, a friend, a relative, something like that. The house of fasting, the literal Hebrew word here is drinking, the house of drinking, and it is a Hebraic way of referring to the celebration at the birth of a child. So, again, we have the contrast between living and death. Now, the last part of verse 2, or 2c, says, because that is the end of every man. Now, I think that Coley is just piling on the bad, negative words to come to a startling kind of conclusion to wake his readers up. And the conclusion is this: fella, you're going to die. There's no way out of it. You're going to die. And we trade our life for cheap little glittering things that come in a night and are gone in a night. We trade true life for vapors that we can touch with our fingers and let real truth and real reality go right across the top without ever seeing it. He's saying, you're going to die. Don't let the world and all the things that go with the world fool you into the fact that they can give you happiness, because they can't. This world and the things of this world are passing away. So, it's like getting slapped in the face, you see. Now, notice when he says, sorrow is better than laughter, and when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. Now, this is not saying that laughter is bad. This is not saying that laughter is necessarily frivolous. This is not saying that having a joyful and countenance toward life is wrong. I think this is saying something like the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, when it says, blessed are the poor. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst. Blessed are the persecuted. People we wouldn't think are blessed at all are blessed, because Jesus is describing their spiritual hunger after God in terms of physical needs or physical deprivation. So what I think we have here is the man who goes to the house to weep with a family who have lost a loved one or something is drawn closer to reality and the fleetingness of life and the transitoriness of our nature than those who go to a party, the good ointment, or those who go to the feast at a birth, for they get so caught up in the laughter and the joyousness of occasion that they let the true reality pass them by. I remember when I was running from God for several years in my life, that it was quite possible in Houston, Texas, to fill up my life with so many things that I didn't have time to think about God for long stretches of time, sometimes going into months. I could have something to do every night. I could have some party to go to, some place that people were laughing, some place that folks were drinking, some place where you get your mind off really what's going on in life. It's possible to so fill your life up with the things of this world that the reality of the transitoriness of life just passes you by. So, that's what I think we have here. Now, another place is 2 Corinthians 7:10 that seems to fit. I think we're talking about sorrow over spiritual things, or that in a sorrow situation you're much more apt to see reality than in a bubbly, excited situation. Now, verse 4. The mind of the wise, and really the word is heart here, not mind, but the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. That's parallel to the house of mourning back in verse 2. But while the mind or the heart of the fool is in the house of pleasure. Now, the house of pleasure, because of the context, has got to almost equal the house of feasting. So what are we saying here? It may be the natural inclination of two different kinds of people. Some kinds of people set their minds on searching out truth. Some people set their hearts and their goals on being pleasing to God and finding God's will and that kind of thing. But other people set their minds and hearts on pleasure, the things that glitter, the things that excite, the things that tantalize the senses. And two different kinds of personalities tend to militate toward one of those two poles. Now, remember, we're still in a context. We can't lose the context, but lose the whole thought. Now, notice the next thing. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. Now, the rebuke of the wise man has got to be somehow parallel to the house of mourning at birth, to the house of mourning as a contrast to frivolous living, whereas the house of feasting and the song of fools and the house of pleasure have got to be somehow synonymous of this riotous living, just enjoying the senses, if you please. Now, you see where it talks about the song of fools there? I think that this passage, verse 5, has got to be related in one of three ways. Now, let me go back and show you how I think it is with the context. Verse 5 may refer back up to verse 1 and 2. If it does, it's talking about, to listen to the rebuke of a wise man, is talking about seeking out God, trying to find God's will, take into account that God is active in life. Now, it's possible that it could refer to sorrow for sin, the rebuke of the wise, and that might go back to sorrow is better than laughter, going back to the Beatitudes of Matthew chapter 5. It could possibly also mean that personal response to life situations is the key, which goes back to verse 4. Some men tend to go after wisdom, some tend to go after pleasure. Now, exactly what it means, I think we're trapped to say exactly what it means, but we can sum up the picture in this. You're going to seek one of two things in life. You are going to try to find the things of God and the things that are real and the things that are going to last and the things that are eternal. Or you're going to set your mind on finding how much your body can experience. Now, you can't do them both. There's not enough time in this life to do them both. You've got to do one or the other. And I think Jesus said that you can't hold on to God and mammon, or the spiritual world and the physical world. You can't. We're a part of this world, but we're not of this world, you see. We live in this world, but we can't be captured by this world. We use the things of this world for God, but we can't let the things of this world use us. Now, that's the contrast, I believe, here. Now, look at verse 6. For the crackling of the thorn bush under the pot. Now, the word for thorn is the word sirim, S-I-R-I-M. The word for pot is the word sir, S-I-R. So, play on words again. Now, usually charcoal is used for setting a fire and keeping a constant heat in the Old Testament. Several passages use charcoal. If charcoal is not available, then what you have to use is grass or sticks, and what's available is thorn bushes. Have you ever started a fire in your fireplace, for those of you who don't have a gas starter, and you get these little sticks and you stick them underneath and you light them and you hear this crack, 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 just burns up real quick? But many times it burns up so fast it doesn't even start the main log you're trying to start. This is the way that the laughter of the fool is epitomized. These little sticks under the pot, they crack and bubble and make noise and a big fire flames up, but the heat's not consistent and the promise of heat doesn't come about. It's the same with the laughter of the fool. Men in our world tend to rush toward folks who seem to be happy. We tend to see somebody who seems to be on top of the situation, and we rush to see where their secret of happiness. But the laughter of fools promises more than it's able to give. There is laughter in a fool for a season, but it doesn't satisfy. It promises more than it's able to deliver. Just like the crackling sticker bushes under a cooking pot. Now, notice that verse 7, I think verse 7 should be a new paragraph. For oppression makes the wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Now, either he's talking about a historical reference, or he's possibly talking about an example of the ways that the fool is trapped in his own wisdom. You see, you can be wise, but you can get caught up in oppression and bribery, and as wise as you are, you're going to get trapped. Nixon reminds me of a man like that. I don't think Nixon was a dummy. I think he was a very intelligent politician. He got trapped by something he didn't realize what it was until it was too late. He got trapped. Now, this is saying that, please, Republicans, don't rush the platform. Even a wise man can get trapped. And sometimes he's given one example, possibly, or one or two. Just a little cut a corner here, a little cheating on the income tax, a little bribe here, a little cutting off what you know is right here, and you think it's just kind of smart, but I want to tell you, that kind of stuff will trap you into a lifestyle of that kind of stuff, which is a fool's lifestyle. So, beginning in verse 8, I would think, is related back to verse 1. The end of the matter is better than its beginning. Now, I've got three possibilities that I've listed what this can mean. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. First possibility, it refers back to verse 1. A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of death is better than the day of birth. It could refer to that. Or two, it could refer to simply another maxim, another proverb that he's quoting, that he's going to say why it's not true. Now, number three, which I probably think number three is best, is you can't really evaluate a thing or a cause or a nation or a life until the life has been lived. For several years, I was assistant pastor with Fred Swank at Sagamore Hill Baptist Church. And through the years, Brother Swank has had numerous preacher boys, as he calls them, who started to preach in his church, and he helped, you know. And he used to have pictures around his office of about 15 of those guys. And I walked in one day, and he was taking all the pictures down. And I said, what are you doing? He left up Billy Graham, by the way, but took the rest up down. And every one of those men had somehow fallen by the wayside. Their ministry was destroyed. They were out of the active ministry as far as the preaching ministry they were in because of something that happened in their life. And this kind of hit me when I thought about this. The things that look so bright and so good at the beginning sometimes never make it to the end. Too many of us live like Roman candles instead of like stars. Too many of our lives are characterized by meteors that shine so bright and outshine everything in the night sky, but are suddenly burned away and destroyed. So friends, I think holding out to the end is a very good maxim. You've got to keep on keeping on. 10 good years is not enough. We've got to stand before God at the very end, the way we begin. You can't judge a man's life at the beginning. No matter how good it may look, it's the end that counts. And I think that's what it's talking about here. Now, notice, if you would please, when it says patience of spirit, 8b, is better than haughtiness of spirit. Now, I think patience of spirit may, because of the context, may refer to the end of something, and the haughtiness of spirit may refer to the beginning of something. Now, patience of spirit must refer, in the context of this man's sarcasm, as a trusting faith in God. The circumstances look bad. Things aren't going good. Life seems futile. There's nothing under the sun but junk. But God's in control. I can't know Him completely, but God's in control. And to have faith in God is a patience of spirit. Now, this idea about haughtiness of spirit or boasting in achievements, you see, is a sign of someone who wants the circumstances right now right and is not willing to wait for the end to see how it's going to turn out. You see, if Job would have been terribly impatient, he would have cursed God and died. But Job hung in there patient until God let him see the end. Now, the next phrase, verse 9, is related to verse 8. Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. Now, James 1:19 and Proverbs 16:32 is very appropriate here. Let me just say it to you that anger is a sign of impatience. Anger is a denial of trust. Anger is a bursting to fruition of the sin nature. Now, many times anger is not wrong when you get mad about the right things. When Jesus cleansed the temple, he wasn't singing "O Little Town of Bethlehem," you know. I mean, he was upset, and it was a scourge he had, not a little sign, "Please leave the premises." He was very upset about that. And he called the Pharisees names you wouldn't call to anybody. He called them a brood of snakes, vipers, whitewashed tombs. And you don't say that when you're smiling. So anger is not bad, but usually the things we get angry about are not the things of God, but frustrations in our own personal lives. So those two references ought to help, I think. Now, verse 10. Why do you say, my tongue is sick tonight. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? Now, have you ever heard it before? The one that always tickles me is, give me the good old days of the Depression. Golly, that's sick. You know, boy, back in the good old days, I walked to school in the snow. That's terrific. That's really good. That's fine. You know, give me the good old days. And usually what that means is, I can't stand the pressure of the present. So put me back someplace that I can't have forgotten the bad things. Remember the good. You give yourself 10 years and you'll have forgotten the bad, thanks be to God, and you'll remember the good. You know that? That's right. Time seems to kill the bad images and bring to the fore the good images. Now, the good old days is just a sign. There ain't no such thing as the good old days. Do you know that? There just ain't no good old days. There's just days. And you either trust God in them or you don't. So, this is a cop-out, if you please. Verse 11. Wisdom, along with a good inheritance, is good. This old boy was practical, wasn't he? He said, it's good to be smart, but sure good to have a dollar in your pants, too. I agree with that. Yeah, much better to be smart and wealthy than smart and stupid, don't you think? Now, who would deny that was a truth? So that's what he's talking along those lines. Now, the next little phrase in verse 11 is very important. And an advantage to those who see the sun. Now, I've been using under the sun as a philosophical tool to say that God has to be taken account of in life. Now, either this means that those who see the sun is relating to wisdom, is that those who recognize God's presence are blessed. It could simply mean that those who see the sun is a way of referring to those who are alive, because the dead don't see the sun, do they? So either it's referring to simply the living, or it's another theological statement about to those who trust God. And boy, I just can't tell what it is in this book, because I just can't. There's no way. I don't think it'd be done. Now, notice in your translation of verse 12 says something like this: for wisdom is protection just as money is protection. Is that what yours says, something like that? What other word is used? It's what? Defense. The Hebrew word here is nothing like that at all. The Hebrew has literally, for in the shadow of wisdom, in the shadow of silver. Does that sound like anything like an English translation? In the shadow of wisdom, in the shadow of silver, no verb, two phrases. Now, to a desert community, what would a shadow mean, a shade? It would mean protection from the sun. So the word protection is probably a little better translation than the word defense. But we're reading quite a bit into this word shadow anyway to get the word protection out of it. Now, how is wisdom and money protection? Well, it's got to go back to this idea about wisdom and inheritance. You see, you've got to look at the context of these things to understand anything what they're talking about. Money's good if you've got wisdom to go with it. Money becomes sick when it eats your lunch and takes control of you. So if you've got enough intelligence and spiritual faith to handle money, money's good. And money can be a protection. Can it? Just as wisdom or godliness can be a protection. It certainly can. Now, notice when it says, last part of verse 12, but the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of its possessors. Now, the Hebrew can be here, wisdom gives life to its possessors. Exactly what it's talking about, I don't know. It may be referring back to Proverbs chapter 8 about wisdom being the first creation of God. I simply do not know there. Okay? Now, in verse 13, consider the work of God, For who is able to straighten what he has bent? Now, what is the Hebrew word for sin? Some of them. Crooked, bent, perverse, missing the mark. Now notice that God is said, the one who is able to straighten what he has bent. Now the word bent has definitely moral overtones in Hebrew. Now look down just a little bit to the last 14c. God has made the one as well as the other. What is the one? One is the day of prosperity and one is the day of adversity. This is the Old Testament understanding, which I like in a real sense, that there are not two causes in life. We don't believe that there's a real fight going on between the powers of evil and the powers of goodness. There is one universal, all-knowing, all-powerful Creator God, period. And everything else is created. So, the natural implication is that if there's one person in control, period, then good and bad come from the same person. You say, yuck. Remember the Old Testament? I forgot where it is. If you look it up, you want to know where this is. The evil spirit of the Lord came upon Saul. You see, they understood one source, one primary cause, God. Now, with fuller revelation, we've come to understand that God has allowed a personal force of evil some degree of control and autonomy in his creation. We know him as Satan. We catch that function in the first chapter of the book of Job. So this is saying that all things come from God. The days of good and the days of bad come from God. And I want to tell you in a real sense, God has to allow it or it just doesn't happen. If you remember the book of Job, Satan asked God, and God gives permission to test Job. Now, so this is a theological Old Testament understanding of one God, all-powerful, all-knowing. So, I think I could sum that up in verse 14 as I've written here. I'm sorry I have to look at my notes more tonight. It's just too detailed for me to remember all this. As I was reading this, the thing that came to me is that God is sovereign but unknowable. Now, unknowable comes from 14c when it says, so that man may not discover anything that will be after him, you see. We can't know God, but God's in control. God gives us the things of life, though they be meager. God gives us the ability to enjoy the things we have, and therefore we are to trust God amidst any circumstance, for he is in control, even though we can't understand him and we can't totally know him. Now, this is Old Testament. Jesus Christ just opens this up like a flower, but this is Old Testament. So, that's what I think the understanding here is. Now, verse 15 is a new paragraph, and we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit. In verse 15, it's talking about righteous man who perishes in his righteousness and the wicked man who prolongs his life in wickedness. So what we got here is a good guy dying young and a wicked man living to a ripe old age, because the Old Testament says what? To live long and be prosperous is a sign of God's blessing. To die young or to die with leprosy or to die poor is a curse of God. Now, what we have is a sandpaper rubbing of Old Testament Orthodox theology and inquiring minds in wisdom literature. Now, traditional Old Testament theology, you may have it down there, let me see. I didn't give it to you, so you can take this down, please. It'd go under 16 of Word and Phrase Study. Traditional Old Testament theology is these verses right here. Psalms 37:25, Proverbs 2:21 and following, and Proverbs 11:19. The good guy, God will bless, and he'll live long. Now, against that theology begin to come a criticism. And the criticism is found in the book of Job, in Psalm 73, and the book of Ecclesiastes. Those things say, I've seen the righteous man squashed, and I've seen the wicked prosper, and I don't understand it, God. Now, Ecclesiastes is picking up on that kind of question against Orthodox theology. So, what does he say? What is the conclusion? What is the summary of this? Look at verse 15 or 16. Do not be exceedingly righteous, and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Now, those who believe this book is written down toward the Greek period, they say this is what we have is the golden mean. Everything is to be done in moderation. Nothing's really bad, just don't do it too much. Now, that may be Greek philosophy. That is not Old Testament theology. That is certainly not Christian theology. Is this saying a little sin's okay? Just don't sin too much? Is this saying, well, certain sins are all right? Is this saying, don't be too godly, don't be too spiritual, don't be too committed? Is that what this is saying? No, 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 no. It is reacting between two ways of living the Christian life, or the life by faith in God. One way is a rigid, dogmatic, unflexible, unforgiving legalism. You step out of line and I'll swat you down. The other is God doesn't really care. He loves us. Everything's fine. We can just live it up. It's total antinomianism, no law. So we got two extremes. Total locked-in dogmatic legalism and woo-hoo-hoo on the other side. Just whatever goes, goes. If it feels good, do it, you know. Everyone's that kind of no rules, too many rules. Now, in the midst of that, I think we've got to understand that exactly what we have here is related to verse 20. Now, it's going to skip a paragraph division. There's no way for me to understand this verse without going to verse 20. But what I think is locked up here, and I'm going to read what I've written. I'm going to read you what's the bottom of my Bible. Verse 17 is not advocating license to sin moderately, but is reluctant to admit man's possibility of becoming perfectly righteous. We must take into account that man still retains a fallen sin nature. Now, let's flip quickly to verse 20 just for a minute. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who does continually do good and never sins. Now, what it's saying is this. It's not saying sin moderately, giving you a license. It's saying don't let it just destroy you when you continue to sin. You're not ever going to be perfect. Don't be so rigid that one sin wipes you out. But on the other hand, don't be so super pious that you can't really relate to life, because you're just kidding yourself, because nobody is that pious. Now, I think that's what we've got here. Not a admonition to everything in moderation, but an admonition against the extremes. And you see that in verse number 18, where it says, it is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other, for the one who fears God comes forth with them both. Them both. What are them both? Well, it's got to be leave both extremes alone. Live in the understanding that you are a sinful, fallen person that's indwelt by the Spirit of God. Matter of fact, I'll go even a little bit further and read 1 John chapter 1, verses 8 through 10. If we say we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we say we have not sinned, we make Him a liar, and His word is not in us. There are two great groups that I see in the Christian church. One group, the group that I was in for the longest time, is a group that knows what God's Word says, tries with every fiber of their being to do the will of God, and when they can't, they just shatter. They try so hard to meet God's standard that when they can't, they just almost give up and fall apart and break loose. The other group is over here. This is called sanctification. The other group is justification. It's a group that says, Jesus died for me, everything's fine, I'll do what I want to, please. It's a group that says, God forgives what I do, get off my back. There's no rule. Now, you can't live at either one of these poles. This thing turns you to putty and you're no good to God at all. This thing makes you so rigid you tend to break and are no good to God at all. We've got to go back and forth between forgiveness and God accepts us the way we are, to strive, run the race, be ye perfect as I am perfect. But when you fail, God accept me the way I am. But keep on running the race to tell you what God wants you to be. It's this tension. I'm going to preach on Sunday the same thing. Romans 7. A tension between God accepting me, but me striving. God loving and forgiving me, but me pushing myself farther into the realms of God's will and of a cleaner, more perfect, more pleasing life to Him. It's got to be both. I think we're talking about here. Now, the little phrase before I leave, back in verse 17, why die before your time? A good passage to that is Luke 12, 16 through 21. This is a guy who sat down and saw his barn and said, man, I've got it made. I'm going to build bigger barns, and I'm going to put up more stores, and I'm going to buy more land, and I'm going to sit back and relax. And God said, you fool, your life is required of you this night. That man died before his time because of his stinking attitude. Now, I want to say, I think the Bible teaches that God will take believers out of their realm of influence if they get too far off, too far away, too far out of His will, too much derogatory in the name of His church. So don't die before your time. And the other side is this. Don't be so spiritual that you ruin yourself. There are some people that are so pious that I hate to be around them. Lord, deliver me from someone who is super pious. Now, let's go to verse 19. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers of a city. Now, I don't know what 10 rulers means. I don't believe Ecclesiastes was written during the Greek period, and we have an allusion here to the way that Greek city-states were run. Baloney. What we have here is a superlative idea in Hebrew. More than the rulers of 10 cities is a way of talking about a superlative idea, that wisdom is greater than this and even this. It's a superlative idea. And we shouldn't try to pin certain things on it. Now, verse 21. And also, do not take seriously all words that are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. Have you ever wanted to read somebody's mind? Have you ever wanted to do that? Just, I wonder what he or she's thinking. If you could read other people's mind, your ego would get smashed. Isn't there times that we say things in our mind that we no more mean after a few minutes or think after a few hours? Have you ever sat in a room and heard somebody talking about you that didn't know you were there? And you just go, they think that? But how many times have you sat off in a room and said things about somebody that you really didn't mean? Don't get uptight when someone says something about you. Don't carry your emotions on your shoulder and just dare someone to knock them off. You'll be miserable. Miserable. Because you know what? I used to sit in chapel. We had forced chapel at Baptist College I went to. I had my own little seat, you know, three times a week right there. Check roll. I used to be so critical of those stinking preachers. That's not right. That guy's weird. Look at his clothes. He didn't comb his hair right. He stutters. I would no more go back and preach in that school because I know what all those guys are thinking because I've been there and thought all those thoughts and they thinking about me. And it'll catch you. So don't wear your emotions on your shoulder. You know, you've said the same thing about others in a moment of anger or things. Don't carry your emotions around on your shoulders. Just don't do it. You'll get in trouble, hurt you, hurt them. Now, verse 23, start a new context, okay? This new context is, wisdom is not easy to find, verses 22 to 25. He's going to try to find it, but boy, it's tough to find. Matter of fact, it can't be found, but it's a good exercise to try. Now, the word exceedingly mysterious in verse 24 is the Hebrew deep. Now, there's very few adjectives in Hebrew. It's an ancient language. So to say something superlative, you say, if you want to say something is super holy, how do you say it in Hebrew? Holy, holy, holy. The message of the seraphim before God? Same thing here. It's not the deepest it can be, but it's pretty deep. It's deep. It's not deep, but it's pretty deep. Now, verse 25, I directed my mind to know. No, I redirected my mind to look at other aspects of the problem that I've already been looking at. And that's the relation to wisdom and folly and that kind of thing. Now, verse 25 is problematic in the sense that, let me read your mind. I redirected my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. Now, many translations say that what he is doing is he's going to search out wisdom and he's going to search out folly. He's going to know this extreme and he's going to know this extreme. He's going to live real wild and see what it's like. He's going to try to live real intelligently and see what it's like. That's not what it's saying. Now, in the New Jerusalem Bible, the New Catholic translation of the Bible, And the New English Bible, what we have here is the word as instead of folly. Like, to know evil as folly and to know foolishness as madness. In the Septuagint, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament that Debbie reads, what we have here is an account that they say foolishness of the ungodly and madness of the ungodly. So, you need to change your translation. If you've got New American Standard, just scratch out the word of and put the word as, because we're not saying he's going to find out both of them. He's going to show by wisdom what these other two are like. Okay? Now, verse 26 is terribly out of context. Right in the middle of the discussion of seeking after wisdom, he drops a strange woman on us, and it just shouldn't be there. Now, and I discovered more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are chains. There's some wild stuff that comes from interpreting this. I really think what it is it's related to verse 25 in saying that I'm going to search out wisdom and keep away from foolishness. And it just kind of comes to his mind, kind of like it did to Paul. You know, Paul will be right along and think of something, just dump it in the context. Totally out of place. Well, this guy's kind of doing that. Maybe he was thinking about foolishness and folly, and his mind ran to the strange woman mentioned in Proverbs many times. The lure of another woman, okay? But that really doesn't fit to me. I think it's the best of the two I'm going to give you, but it doesn't satisfy much. Loophole, my good friend Loophole, and one of the best commentators that I know, one of the most conservative German commentators called Hengstenberg of the last century, both say the strange woman here refers to pagan philosophy. Now, where do you think how far off the wall they get with that? They say, well, what we have here is a feminine pronoun used in verse 27. You got the noun, masculine, a feminine pronoun. So, what we have here, I'll just give you their argument, and you just write it down, see if you can follow it, okay, when you look at it home. In Proverbs 7:4 and Proverbs 9:1 following, this idea of a woman refers not to a real woman, but to pagan mythology. In verses 28 and 29, it seems to add to the possibility of symbolism because of the ideal of they hadn't found a woman yet who's worth her salt, and they hadn't found a smart girl yet, and on. So they take these kind of deals to say this passage is symbolic, talking about pagan philosophy is over against the wisdom of God. That don't really fit to me. I think you're really pushing the text to get pagan philosophy out of a strange woman. I really do. I think the best thing is to me, take it just as literally as you can, and he just has duped the context up. One of these pearls on a string, he just jumps context. Now, but listen at verse 28, all you feminists, and you can rush the platform of the Republicans, which I am still seeking, but I have not found. I have found one man among a thousand, but I have not found a woman among all of these. A woman what? Well, he's talking about a good, intelligent woman. Now, before you get terribly labeled this guy as chauvinist, I want you to think this. He does say that he hadn't found a woman yet that he thinks is smart. But notice how much better he makes men. Men are 0.1% better than a woman. That's not a whole lot better any way you add it up, right? 1 out of 1,000 is 0.1%. So men are smarter 0.1%. Really, he just down everybody. I think what he's talking about is not just smashing women's rights and all. He's in a context. His day was one when women, of course, were cattle, and they weren't educated, and they didn't have a chance to come out. So I can understand the historical context. But what he's saying is that sin nature has got all of us trapped. Sin nature has pulled everybody down. It's pulled womankind down, and it's pulled mankind down. And what we have here is just an example of fallen, frustrated mankind. And I don't know what else that means, my soul. Behold, I have found this, that God makes men upright, but they have sought out many devices. Some folks actually say the they in verse 29 refers to women. So, God has made man upright, but women have sought out many devices. That's not true. The pronoun there is masculine, it's plural. Can't refer to women. But I think it's referring to fallen nature, and I really don't know what else it means. And I think I'm going to say good night on that count.